And on with take three. You're very welcome. Thank you for downloading us. It's nice to be back in your lives this week. This is the part where we answer your questions, film-related stuff, and shmestions, which is not film-related stuff. A couple of weeks ago, we asked for an authentically Yiddish rendition of our feature title.
Yes.
And I'm pleased to say we have a winner. Here's an email from James and family. Dear Come On, Come On, and Hurry Up, Ariaster, Come On, and hello to puppet runner Simon, Cord of the King Flynn, Johnny Socials, etc., and Jason, of course. This is James in Sunny Ladywell. Long-term listener, as I think we've gathered, legacy listener, Vanguard Easter, silver survival swimming badge, grade 5 French horn, and member of Bass Player's Pocket.
Yes.
Blimey. In response to your request, I attach a recording of the Mrs. Award-winning actor indoors, Sarah Wilson Chen, a.k.a. Swifty, communicating with her relations to provide your actual Yiddish. Also, as an added bonus, daughter number one, declaring their love for their boyfriend of 1 year standing. All life is here. Hurrah for pipe-smoking banshees and bluehead feminists. Tickety-tong, down with the Nazis, James in Sunny Ladywell. So, here is a heavily edited version of James's submission.
This is questions.
Smashions.
Questions. Yes. Let us just take a number of takes on this.
Yeah,
please, in your own time, please say...
Questions, schmeshtions.
Okay, let's take one. Okay, take two. Can I just say, please, just questions, schmeshtions.
Questions, schmeshtions. Lo, ze lo haya tov. Questions.
Enough already. Okay? Enough already.
I miss Cosmo!
Wow.
It's like a family epic.
It was a slice of human life, wasn't it?
So we now have three options for the sweeper, as we call them in audio world, created by the redactor himself. First, we have the klezmer version. I think that's a strong contender.
That's a very strong contender.
That feels very good. There's also the Golden Age of Hollywood option.
Questions.
I mean, it's good. It's usable.
First one's still better.
First one's better. Okay. And finally, we have a drum and bass remix. Okay, here we go. Boom. Ooh, yatta-ta-ta. Well, I think that was pretty good, actually. I like that.
Yeah, that reminded me of Mayo and Chunks, which, incidentally, I watched the minute it appeared. Wow.
Yeah. I thought that was an entertaining item. Did you not think?
Okay, so of the three of those, the first one is absolutely the banger, isn't it? It's got to be the first one.
Definitely the first one?
Yeah, don't you think?
Okay, let's eliminate the Hollywood option. Let's do klezmer versus drum and bass.
Okay,
it's klezmer. So klezmer again.
Questions.
That seems to be...
That's great.
...on cue. That sounds as though we've got the voice, like, waiting for the band to finish.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's klezmer versus drum and bass. Here we go. Yeah. Okay. I don't want to hear that every week, though. So I think I would look forward to it more.
That's the key, isn't
if
it?
We had Klezmer version.
Yes, you don't want to hear it every week. Twice was more than enough.
Okay. So we decide, is that okay? We go, Klezmer's the winner. Okay. So now that this is all sorted. So let's have the sweeper, then we'll do the questions and the schmesters. Okay. Here we go.
Smestions.
Oi! Joanna H. in Wiltshire. Mark and Simon, a question. If you could transport yourselves into any scene from a movie, whether to influence it or merely experience it, which would you choose? Mm. Personally, I'd go for David Cronenberg's remake of The Fly, so I could leap in front of Seth Brundle as he's about to enter the telepod screaming, "Don't do it, you beautiful man!" Admittedly, this would make the second half of the film far less interesting. But hey, keep up the good work with the podcast. Tickety-tonk, down with the Nazis, Joanna. So this is quite a tricky one. So you have to be in a scene, whether to influence it or merely experience it.
Can I leap in here, because there is something that is, and it's not an influence, it's not a change thing. I have always wanted to be at the Cayley in Local Hero, and in fact, when we went with Bill Forsyth with the Culture Show back to the village where they shot the village scenes in the seafront scenes in Local Hero, and they had just rebuilt the village hall, and the Ace Tones, who are the Cayley band, who perform at the Cayley. Performed then, and I thought, this is the closest I'm ever going to get to being in the scene, but I would so love to have been at that Cayley that's in Local Hero, not to influence it, not to change it, but just to be there and have a drink and just, I wish it was real, and in my head it is. What about you?
I think I'd like to be in the final scene in Ratatouille. I think that would be quite good.
What's the final scene when he has the
Fiddler on the Roof?
Hey, the final scene in Ratatouille, is that when he eats the pasta?
When the critic finally,
yes,
you know, gets it.
Yeah, it's something like it's like a really simple dish, isn't it? It's like pasta or something really.
Yeah, I'd like to be in The Road so I could just have cheered everyone up a little bit. Just maybe appeared next to Viggo Mortensen and told him a joke. Maybe the joke that I told. You know, my wife's having an affair with a plumber.
Can I just say, on the subject of if there's a scene that you'd like to influence, I'd like to be there at the end of The Mist and go, "It's all right, it's the army."
Okay, I feel, Joanna, you might have started something. Films that you'd like to. So this is not favourite films or even favourite scenes in films. This is the scene that you'd like to be in, to chip in and influence,
or to turn up in Romeo and Juliet when you go, "It's okay. It's a drug, it'll wear off."
Right. Okay, next question. This comes from Dr. Adrian Haslam, LTL, previous unread emailer, Vanguard Easter and Quack, the type that puts their hand up when a pilot asks, "Is there a doctor on board?" If we're still doing post-nominals, then feel free to guess what mine stand for. Right, he's got lots. MBCHB ONS. BSC, I know the BSC.
Bachelor of Science.
MRCGP. DFSRH and DRCOG. So
DIVORCE.
Yes.
RSVP. One of them, MB, isn't that a member of the Bath or something? Isn't that that?
APOCYLPS Apocalypse. Dr. Cog, that's got to be Diploma of Royal Congratulations or Gratuitous something or other. Anyway, so we don't know. Clearly Adrian is more qualified than we are.
Clever.
He says, Clever Clogs Haslam, as he's known. Films are often described or inferred to the consumer as being the product or property of the director. For example, Ridley Scott's Alien.
Yes.
This is despite the fact that in many cases, it was devised, developed, and written entirely by other people, acted, costumed, lit, and lensed by other people. The location scouts choose the backgrounds, the casting director, the foregrounds. To a layperson like me, surely the writer, the person or people who created the story and the plot, surely they are the largest and most important contributors, and all films should be credited primarily to them in the press. So, for example, not Ridley Scott's Alien, but Dan O'Bannon's Alien. What does the director contribute that is so key that they are lauded above all others, including sometimes even the actors and always the writers? I have never fully understood exactly what the role of a director is and why they take such centre stage and seem to earn such vast sums whilst writers often sweat in obscurity. I entirely agree with everything that Adrian is saying. Yeah. The above is a genuine question and not an attack on directors, who I'm quite sure deserve their kudos. Clearly there are exceptions like Tarantino, who seems to do everything from conception to direction and well deserve to have their name to be synonymous with the film title. But Tinkety Tonk, and thanks for being such genuine value, like Battenberg, and up with strong, consistent leadership. 10 more years. I'm not sure about strong, consistent leadership myself anymore. But anyway,
let me give you a genuine value answer. Okay, so the idea of the director owning the film is actually a fairly recent idea, and you can trace it back to the birth of auteur theory. In the early days of cinema, the producer was often thought of as the owner of a film, and the director was entirely secondary. So there are entire decades of cinema in which people don't talk about the director. I mean, you know, like if you look at The Wizard of Oz, there's five people working on it, or it's the producer was seen as the overarching, the most important thing, because the producer is the person who commissions the script, who pays the money, who hires the director, who hires the actor. So in many ways, you could say if there is any overarching person, it is the producer or the production company. The idea that the director owns the film, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, or you know, that really comes from the rise of auteur theory, which says that there are some directors whose films always have a distinctive flavor of them, regardless of what the film is. Now, exactly what constitutes an auteur? So if you look at Orson Welles on Citizen Kane, I mean, Welles did have a hand in the script writing, although obviously, as everyone knows from Mank, there's that thing when Gary Oldman does the acceptance speech saying, I received this award in much the same way that I wrote the film without the presence of Orson Welles. But the idea is that Orson Welles is the overarching auteur of the film, and it is his vision. And then essentially what happened when auteur theory began was they started looking back at what we would now call working directors, jobbing directors, and say, well, actually, you can say that John Ford, his films, no matter what they are, all have a feeling of being John Ford. But it is a critical movement that began not by saying that all directors are in charge of their films, but saying that there are certain directors that you can identify as having a distinctive flavour throughout their career, and their auteur directors, as opposed to, I suppose, what would disparagingly be referred to as, as jobbing directors. In fact, that theory is still very, very controversial, and many people would argue the writer is more important. Many people would argue the producer is more important. We've kind of got to a point now when, I do the Production Designers Guild Awards, and I've heard production designers argue that really it's the production designer's film that you're talking about. So it is by no means the case that all directors exert an overpowering influence on the film, so it is their film. I think you could say, for example, it is Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, in as much as that film is entirely his fault. But the idea that it's Michael Cimino's Deer Hunter is rather different, because Cimino took credit for umpteen things on the Deer Hunter for which he should never have taken credit, which he completely erroneously took credit for, wanting to make himself into a great auteur director. And when he was actually allowed to be that, he destroyed his studio. My favourite film of all time. Is it William Friedkin's The Exorcist, or is it William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist? In fact, when it came to the poster and the film, the poster says William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, directed by William Friedkin. And then on the film, it says The Exorcist, directed by William Friedkin, produced and written by William. So they change the thing around because they understand that it's the tension at the centre of it. The idea that the director is the overpowering force is a controversial idea that is comparatively recent. I mean, we're talking 60s, really, and is often sneered at by people who have actually made films.
Yes. Well, let's hear it for the writers.
Yeah. That was fairly thorough, wasn't it? I thought that was pretty good.
It was a masterclass, Mark. Masterclass. Thank you. Stuart Lorne My 9-year-old lad has never seen a Bond film and really wants to watch one. What do the good doctors think is the best gateway Bond film for his age? Classic Connery or Action Man Craig? He's seen all the Marvel DC movies, even the bad ones, so can handle a smidge of violence. I would suggest, Stuart, that actually, because you have to be quite careful about this, I would think GoldenEye. So I'm not going with Classic Connery or Action Man Craig, but GoldenEye is fun, has got some good action pieces. The music is very good, and I think it's Pierce Brosnan's finest James Bond. It's just, if you're 9 years old, I think that's probably an easier way to start.
Do you think the Craigs are too tough?
Yeah, I would have thought. I mean, Marvel will have toughened up most people, but I think just as an entry point. Also, there's a, you know, the GoldenEye game is the last computer game that I played with any sense of enjoyment.
Okay.
So I think GoldenEye would be a good entry point for Bond. What do you think?
Okay, I mean, my entry point for Bond was Live and Let Die, which there's so many problems with Live and Let Die nowadays.
Yeah.
But so the first Bond I ever saw was Roger Moore, and the Roger Moore Bonds, like Man with the Golden Gun and things like that, they were fun for the age that I was. But I do remember my parents went to see Live and Let Die first to check out whether they thought it was acceptable. I think it perhaps tells you something about whether they thought it was. But the Roger Moores are all kind of fairly innocuous. Of the Sean Connerys, I mean, you know, Thunderball's fun. Dr. No's, all those early Connerys, they all have a series of problems that, you know, that we know about sort of later on, but I think they're all solidly manageable because they were all sort of designed as family entertainment. The point at which Bond actually gets tougher than family entertainment is Timothy Dalton. It was the Timothy Dalton movies that pushed it into the realm of, you know, really sort of tough, gritty. People always forget this when they think about Casino Royale, the Daniel Craig Casino Royale being the, oh, I'll tell you what, yeah, start with the unofficial, the original Casino Royale, because that'll put you off Bond forever. I'll go with GoldenEye is a good call, probably.
Schmestions, John Penny, if you consider Elvis's career as having, so already we're into Mark's specialist subject. If you consider Elvis's career as having five acts, Sun Records, Pre-Army, RCA, Hollywood, 68 Comeback, and finally Vegas. What's your favourite and what's your least favourite? I have quite a soft spot for all his incarnations, but would probably put the Comeback era and the subsequent From Elvis in Memphis album as my top incarnation. I'm kind of expecting the Skiffle King to go for the first era and to regale us with stories of recording at Sun Studios, but I have no idea what Simon would suggest. Everybody will probably say that the Hollywood era is their least favourite, but There's No Room to Rumba in a Sports Car is an amazing record. Says John. Well, I will go Elvis is Mark's thing very much, but I think the Sun Records period is, you know, the thin Elvis, the Elvis that's in that extraordinary, in the movie where he's in that extraordinary kind of possessed stage, I think is probably my favorite. That's what I go for. But Mark is the man with the knowledge here.
No, I mean, I go for the Sun period as well. I have a fondness for the Las Vegas years. When they did that box set of the Elvis 70s recording, there were some great live performances from the Vegas years, which are great. I think you probably agree with this, the Hollywood period is the low point. I remember Andy Gill once saying that he referred to Elvis as a three-act tragedy with no second act. You know, he thought the whole problem was everything from Elvis coming out of the army to 68 Comeback Special was just a wasteland, was just like a kind of an absence. So I think, but the Sun period, because that's also when you hear the danger. That's also when you hear people were genuinely terrified by the specter of Elvis. What is this going to do to the world that this young man is making this sound and it is being heard on the radio? So yeah, I think the Sun, if Act One, the Sun period, and then certainly the Hollywood years would be the worst.
I do have a fondness for Wooden Heart, actually.
Yeah, I mean, even in the
what
worst
period, is
period
that in?
Well, that's the Hollywood period.
Oh, is that Hollywood?
Know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Sarah Lynch, how did the idea of describing your children as child one, child two, child three on your shows come about? And do you ever find yourself inadvertently using those names at home instead of their real ones? I think it was just, if you're talking about movies the way we have done over the period that we have been doing it, you need to be able to include your family in that conversation, because so much of what we're talking about involves either children's films or teenage films or family films. So therefore, what they had to say about life seemed to be relevant. And I didn't particularly want to talk about them by name because it seemed a little bit intrusive. So one, two, and three just seemed to be the obvious thing, I think. I mean, I can't actually remember how it started.
But when that, we no, did that, our, it, is that is how exactly yeah. how it started. Because both you and I have always felt that, you know, us making idiots of ourselves in public is our business, but we have no right to drag other members of our family into it, other than, as you say, in reference to the fact that it's impossible to talk about movies in the way we have without doing so. And you were the person who started mentioning it. And I think the first time you used it, and I may be incorrect, was in reference to Child 2's love of Twilight, because you talked about to the Twilight premiere with Child 2 and Kristen Stewart being very, very sort of monosyllabic and mumbling, and you thinking, step up, you know, this is a big moment. I think that's the first time I remember
that. I was thinking it might have, yes. Well, the reason why I think you have to talk about your kids is, for example, when we did the first Toy Story movie long time ago, I remember going to see it because it was a PG, and I went to see it before I took Child 1 to see it because he hadn't seen a PG before. And I was thinking, why is this going to be a PG? And obviously there's the doll torturing scene, which is,
still terrifying.
Which is still terrifying. So, therefore, it felt as though it would have been an incomplete reaction for me to talk about Toy Story without talking about, well, this is how it felt taking a kid to see their first PG film. So I just think it's just a neat way. And in fact, when we did our live show at Halloween. Lena Dunham in the bar afterwards was introduced to Child 3 and she said, oh, you're Child 3. And Child 3 said yes, and they had a little conversation.
And my Child 1.
Yes. So I thought that was all quite fun. Rob Newlin, who put the ram in the Ram-a-Lama Ding Dong? Who put the bop in the bop shabop shabop? And why did it have to be a man? Because then there's a line, who was the man? I'd like to shake his hand. Did it have to be a man, or is that just because man rhymes with the hand, even if it actually doesn't? And was the ding dong in that line ever sung by the sorely missed Leslie Phillips? I don't think that was the case. But it's a good song. But the thing is, it almost certainly was a man, wasn't it, back in the day?
I don't think you can ever nail it down. And then, of course, the reason that song works is because, you know, who can possibly say who put the ram in the ram and lama ding dong, who put the bop in the bop shibop shibop?
Would it have been the same person who put the ram as the bop?
Probably a series of different people were all assigned duties, and they may have been of any or no gender at all. Can I just say quickly, the Biffers, I believe this year, are non-gendered in their acting awards. I believe that's correct. Okay. Talked about that before. Yeah, carry on.
Ben in Hertfordshire, finally, I'd like to ask Mark what his favourite Japanese whiskies are, and in an attempt to make it relevant, which Japanese films he would pair them with.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Okay, well, I don't know how much of this we were allowed to do. Just briefly, Japanese whiskies are you take a walk in the woods of Japanese whiskies. There's so much to discover. My favorite discovery was Ali, whose house I'm in at the moment. Ali and I went to the local pub here. It was reopening outside after the lockdown stuff. And Ali had got me a bottle of Nikadaze, which is, it's a powerful drinking whiskey, but it's called Nikadaze, which kind of gives you the impression that it's the kind of thing that you could maybe have a sharpener during the daytime. You can't. It's a full strength whiskey. But we were there in the pub that we were at, which is a very, very lovely pub. The guy who was in charge of the pub came out and went, oh, have you got a bottle of Nikadaze? And Ali said, yeah, I've just got it for Mark as a present. And he was so excited to see it because he hadn't actually seen it. So we got him to get three glasses from behind the bar, and we each had one, and we all agreed, you know, on how delightful it was and how, you know, how the springiness that it had to its, you know, was it's not a, because they're not peaty whiskies at all, the Japanese whiskies. So Nika Days will always have a place in my heart because it's the only time I have taken a drink to a pub. And the guy who owned the pub asked me if he could have one.
And what Japanese film are we going to be watching that with?
Well, the other thing I was going to say was that there's a big joke about, you know, for good times, make it Suntory time. And, you know, all that stuff at the end of Lost in Translation, that the gag is that it's a Japanese whiskey. And I think that the way that was originally received was, you know, because it's a Japanese whiskey and who would be drinking Suntory time? But actually, Suntory time is a perfectly reasonable, because they're very, very good whiskeys. So I would say, although it's not a Suntory thing, that gag now looks very different to me. When I first saw Lost in Translation, I didn't know Japanese whiskey from a hole in the ground. So I would say, you know, round about 7-8 o'clock, have yourself a Nika Days whilst watching Bill Murray say, for good times, make it Suntory time.
It should be noted that despite Mark twerking for free Japanese whiskey on multiple occasions, none has been forthcoming. Might that change? Do any media planners who represent those brands want to get in touch? Although
I did get given a bottle of Japanese whiskey by a film. I will remain anonymous because, you know, but, and it wasn't at the time that she had a film out. But it was at the end of a year, and there was a film that she had made that you and I had both particularly loved. And then at Christmas, she sent me a fantastic bottle of Japanese whiskey.
Well, she didn't send me anything, so I didn't like it quite as much as I obviously gave the impression that I did. But if we're twerking, Lacrimosa, the game about the death of Mozart, which is 60 quid, I'd be intrigued to play it. It's apparently a game like none other, highly strategic, mechanically innovative, with a lovely presentation. Okay, if you have any questions or smestions, the questions are about films, smestions are about life in general, send them to correspondence@curbitomeo.com. Thank you very much indeed. Keep them coming in. And thanks to James in Sunny Ladywell, Sarit Wilson-Chen and relatives for providing us with our top new jingle. Thank you for listening.